This is The Conversation, a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the art worlds. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. I missed you guys. It's episode 237 with Anna Schachty. She is a Los Angeles-based artist, recent, fairly 3.5 years ago, roughly, transplant from New York. She was also one of the core members of a pretty well-known artist-run gallery called Regina Rex, which went all the way from being in a gallery in Bushwick to doing art fairs to landing as a gallery on the Lower East Side. So we talk about that. We also talk about how and why she moved from New York to Los Angeles and all the various economic and personal reasons behind that. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of Anna's work over the years, as well as some Regina Rex shows, a Regina Rex meeting on the roof with a nice view. And of course, you can also find past episodes, including last episode with Jeff Weiss, he of old news, that what I used to call Weiss Links. I heard from Jeff, in fact, that a number of you, maybe a handful or more, signed on to the waiting list to get on to become an old news recipient via email. And I'm really curious to know why you did that, whether it was for the convenience of just getting all that art news in email as opposed to having to go to the specific link to get it, or maybe it was as much or more being part of a limited group of recipients. I didn't hear from any of you letting me know that you heard Jeff and you went and signed up, so I would love to do so now, maybe just one of you even. Well, I'd be very curious to know why you signed up to be on the waiting list, and eventually, maybe a year and a half, 2 years down the road, you will join the pantheon of 1800 of old news recipients. I'm going to give you a preface to the New York to LA thing, which I heard about recently and I think is an interesting way to launch into our conversation. But first, I do have some old news for you on the back end. And I recently went to an art fair. You may have heard about all the art fair activity going on here in Los Angeles last week. I went to one of them. And it's not the one that you probably think. It's actually ALAC, Art Los Angeles Contemporary. So I'll tell you about my experience briefly on the back end along with the old news. And before I get to that preface of today's episode, to today's conversation, the announcements are thus. First of all, The Conversation's own producer Andy Davis is in a pop-up group show, which is on the ground floor of 222 Bowery, which is right across from the new museum. The show is titled Abzu, that's A-B-Z-U. The opening is this coming Tuesday, February 26th from 5 to 8, and it's only running until March 2nd. So if you can make that opening, go say hello to Andy. Go introduce yourself. Let him know you listen to the show if you're in New York. And for any of you who are or will be in El Paso, Texas, Julie Speed, who is a supporter of the show, has a show called East of the Sun and West of the Moon, which is 48 paintings and close-up room of three-screen video installation, and that runs until April 7th. So go check that out if you're going to be in El Paso. All right, before we jump in, I was listening to the actor Matt Smith, who is playing Robert Mapplethorpe in the biopic of Robert Mapplethorpe coming out in about a week from when this launches. And he was on with the director, and he was asked about how he liked New York. I guess he's a Londoner primarily. And he said he loves it. He really loves his hotel, the Bowery Hotel, I believe it was. And then he referred to this quote, and the way that he told it was about New York, I think everybody should live there at least once, at least for a year, and then leave before you get hard. And then he said, and I think everybody should live in LA at least once for at least a year and leave before you get soft. So I looked that up to see if I got the wording right. And he actually got that from, it's a quote from Mary Schmitz's, I guess, book, Wear Sunscreen, A Primer for Real Life. And her version, the real version, is actually live in New York City once, but leave before it makes you hard. Live in Northern California once, but leave before it makes you soft. So I wonder if she's referring to sort of the tech crowd, because she's talking about Northern Cal and New York City, which are well populated by tech people, more than LA. So in any case, wanted to mention that as a background slash preface to the conversation that we have coming up with Anna. And I want to just finally say that that sentiment may have been much more true 15, 20 years ago, but over the last 10, 15 years, much less so. I would say it's about maybe 40% accurate, 60% bullshit, something like that. See what you think once you hear our conversation. All right, I'll talk to you more on the back end. Thank you for being here. Would you say it was more, in retrospect, a gradual decision to we need to leave New York? Or do you feel like you, if you look back, there was one particular turning point or breaking point?
Yeah, it was sort of a cumulative effect till this. We got to like a tipping point of, it was really when we opened our minds to the possibility of leaving. And then the relief, the sense of relief, like a weight being lifted off of our shoulders.
Right.
That felt so good that we decided to go with that feeling. And the more we sort of looked into the different possibilities for housing or school, you know, elementary school for our older daughter, the more it was like, why not, you know? And so, yeah, it was sort of this, like I said, accumulation of a lot of little major life things piling up. And years prior to that, friends leaving New York, having sort of major road sign, life road sign saying, time to go this way, you know, exit, mm-hmm. and, you know, different cities kind of, you know, making themselves obvious to different friends for different next chapters in their lives. And we'd always been sort of vaguely envious. Mm-hmm. New York had been sort of like the city of diminishing returns for several years, you
right,
know, like
right.
working harder to pay more for less benefits, you know. So
right.
we opened our minds to a move, and it turned out that embracing the change and the radical change that we knew that was coming with a second kid, and just kind of like trying to ride the waves of change instead of being fearful of them.
Right.
Is what catalyzed this, like, wow, why don't we just move this, you know, somewhere else completely different instead of looking for a different neighborhood in Brooklyn, let's look for a different neighborhood in LA.
Couple questions
that's what we
for
did.
You.
Mm-hmm.
One, you mentioned you're sort of being a little envious of some friends who are like having these life changes, you know, including moving out of the city, you know, being a big part of that. Can you recall what some of the different, was it like a variety of locations that people you knew were moving to?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, you know, one of my best friends from growing up in South Carolina had been living in San Francisco for a long time. And, you know, years earlier when she and her husband were expecting their second kid, all of a sudden it became obvious to them that they needed to move home to Charleston and, you know, bunk in with her mom. And this was an arrangement that worked out to be mutually beneficial for everyone. And not what I wanted to do, but just the sort of seemingly synchronistic, you know, events coming together for her and her family. And it being like, well, that makes all the sense in the world. It wouldn't make sense for us to move home and move in with my parents at that time in our life. But that's just one example.
So when you heard about your friends moving to these different places, do you recall that there was part of you maybe in some case that felt a little sorry for them? Or was it always generally that you were happy that they had found, you know, that they found a different situation that was going to be better for them?
Oh, definitely the latter. And if anything, if I felt sorry for anyone, it would be myself for having to say goodbye to a dear friend and, you know, compatriot in the battle. I mean, I think a lot of people have a kind of love affair with New York City because it does have a lot of very specific demands and idiosyncrasies for getting along there that you don't really find, you know, they're really unique to that city. But once you get invested in it, it's kind of ruins you for living in many other places.
It's an interesting dynamic because on one hand, in one way, you're getting ruined for other places, you know, because of all the opportunities and resources, if you will, that you have in New York. But then there's also this sort of pro-con kind of dynamic, right, where you were probably, when you were sort of feeling sad for your own situation when you saw your friends leaving, maybe that was also a sign that the cons were, you know, were maybe slightly starting to overtake the pros in some way.
Sure. And the booming, successful economy of New York City, growing at this breakneck pace, and the big real estate boom, while it has a lot of positive effects for a lot of people, didn't really help it, you know, be a hospitable place for artists to live and work.
Yeah, and you were there over a period of years, decade and a half or so, that really was kind of this core or sort of extreme growth period, I should say, and growth inequality period. So my question is, do you think in retrospect that you saw some of that as it was going, or was it more of a you woke up one day kind of thing and, wow, you know, I can't believe what I'm seeing?
I mean, it's kind of a mix of both. I mean, definitely over the span that I was in that Williamsburg, Greenpoint area, 98 to 2015, mm-hmm. I wasn't the first artist in Williamsburg by a long stretch, but maybe in that second or third wave of artists settling Williamsburg. It kind of ebbed and flowed. You know, there was a lot of new construction and rezoning, I'm sure you know the story, along the North Brooklyn waterfront. And these, you know, the skyline started to change and these, you know, multi-story buildings started popping up. And then when the bottom fell out of the subprime housing market, mm-hmm. And the ripple effect of that, you could see construction just coming to a screeching halt, and these half-finished, quote-unquote, luxury condos just sort of languished, and you'd see the, you know, the seasons pass and the sort of Tyvek flapping in the wind as you walk by.
Right, that's a great image.
And that was when I was still, when I was before we had kids. And so to answer your question, it was a gradual thing that ebbed and flowed, but I do remember that when we became parents and we sort of got to see the neighborhood from a different point of view, at different hours of the day, maybe, and you started to see more strollers, you know, going up and down Bedford Avenue and stuff like that. And I joined like a neighborhood moms group, and I started meeting other moms in the neighborhood. A lot of them were the folks that had bought these new units. You saw a huge population explosion in the neighborhood.
Right.
And just making a generalization here, a lot of the folks that were moving into those units were first-time parents that had just had a kid born in the same year as my kid. So that was like, I sort of saw mm-hmm. this population for the first time that I don't think I would have crossed paths with or noticed, but it did seem like all of a sudden, you know, when people were remarking about how like they loved such and such of, you know, their brand stroller because it's just so easy to roll right onto the elevator and right into the lobby. You know, like, there are buildings in this neighborhood that have elevators? What? Like, you know, and of course I had been seeing them being built, but then I'd had this moment where I was like, oh, it's not happening now. You know, like, construction has stopped. And then like another year or two passed and I didn't really, it seemed like all of a sudden the streets were bustling with these, you know, new families that had moved into the neighborhood, and they were my new peers as well.
Were they your peers? I mean, how did these people strike you in terms of their demographic? Did they seem, was it a full mix, or did you generally feel like that they were a wealthy creative class, or just a wealthy, like, you know, banker, lawyer, you know, other professional type class?
Well, I mean, I guess that's like the disconnect that I'm like getting at, ever so circuitously, that these people were my peers and that I was in mom groups and play groups with them. You know, we being parents of the same age with kids the same age and, you know, future, you know, fellow class parents and stuff like that. And yet I felt a really jarring disconnection from, you know, being, like I said, had said in earlier conversations, an artist that always made my own way, whether it was from bartending or doing freelance jobs or, you know, doing a lot of the type of work that I was not able to do any longer being a parent of a young baby. So still feeling like the struggle really acutely of being an artist and trying to like juggle and make ends meet. And then realizing that my peers in my neighborhood where I had been for a long time were of a much more affluent, you know, professional echelon that I had never really intersected with before in that neighborhood or in my time living in New York.
And what was that like, encountering or, you know, being friends with or just chatting with these people?
Well, it was really awkward for me in the beginning, and I want to be quick to point out that all of this, I'm trying to describe a sort of inner turmoil and identity crisis that coincided with all of these things, you know. So I'm making these broad generalizations about people who live in the luxury high rises, and I'm sure there's many wonderful people, but, you know, I was totally unprepared for, the radical life change of being a mom and having, a little being dependent on me for life and food and that is literally attached to your body at all times and, really impeded my ability to work in my studio and be by myself or be alone with my thoughts. And so I think noticing the economic differences or the differences in affluence and privilege between myself and my new mom peers kind of just inflamed a really already like deep sense of like emergency in terms of like the survival of my identity as an artist and as a individual.
What did the forecast look like before, you know, when you were pregnant or even before that, as far as, you know, what you anticipated versus what it became?
Well, funny you should ask, because, you know, the dominoes had already started to be put in motion from the housing crisis, you know, the big crash in 08 and 09. And it was definitely starting to trickle through to the art market. But prior to getting pregnant, the time between graduating grad school in 2004 and getting pregnant in 2009, things had really been kind of booming in the art world in New York, and things had been sort of more open. You know, this is all leading up to the the story that we all know about the economic crash. And so there were a lot of galleries. There was the era of the apartment gallery. People were, if they had an apartment in Chelsea, you know, it was just so, there was so much going on in terms of showing and selling art in Chelsea, you know, in those early aughts. And so, you know, there were just a lot of galleries and there were a lot of opportunities for young artists to have first shows and to start selling their work. And so I was really fortunate to be a part of one of these young galleries that was first in a apartment space called Taxer and Spangman. And so I was able to have my first solo show months after graduating from grad school and have it sell out. And so back to your question about what was the forecast, you know, that gives you an idea of what the climate was like when I sort of took my first adult steps into the art world. And so definitely felt, you know, had the false sense that this was just sort of like the beginning of just really happy times making art and making some good money while doing it.
Right.
But so fast forward a few years, you know, I had a couple of successful solo shows with Taxer and Spangman. And then, you know, things changed in the overall art market and things changed for them. And just coincidentally, we ended up parting ways and severing our gallery artist relationship right exactly coinciding with the beginning of my pregnancy. And so, again, totally coincidental, but also coincidentally rather difficult for me when, you know, I had a stream of income, I had exhibition opportunities, I had a certain amount of feeling like I had an audience. You know, when I was in the studio, I always felt like I had a little bit more confidence because I could easily imagine the next show that this work was going to fit into. And along with all of the physical and emotional and psychological changes that come with pregnancy and the changes in that can be very isolating and alienating from, you know, your social group. And, you know, I just felt like that year and the couple years after, I was really like fighting against this feeling of like just disappearing, you know, becoming more and more invisible by the day. And so that sort of informs my previous comments about having this crisis of identity and crisis, you know, feeling like my identity or myself as an artist was seriously challenged, you know, throughout all of these things happening all at once.
Right. When you had your second show, so, you know, that was a time of perhaps the greatest momentum. Was your plan or was your sort of casual vision for the future that this would basically continue, that you would be a full-time artist making a living from your work?
Yeah. I mean, I can sort of laugh out loud about it now because it seems so naive
right.
to think it could be so easy. But,
right.
And I look back and I feel so grateful mm-hmm. and appreciative for that time and for those opportunities, you know, to have a solo show right out of grad school and to be able to hit the ground running and have my rent, to be able to pay my studio rent and work freelance and part-time and never, you know, I've always said that I failed to professionalize in a backup career. You hear people who go to art school but then they got a great job, you know, somewhere. And then before they know it, they're a professional something else, you know. And I kind of have always, you know, I've been lucky enough to manage to avoid professionalizing in a backup career. the downside of that is, one doesn't have great earning power if their value in the art market is down.
Right.
Which, as you can imagine, it's very mercurial.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to sort of contextualize your early success in a couple of different ways. There's one way of looking at it that, sure, I mean, the best time to capitalize on momentum is when you're sort of a new artist to the market, right? Because that's when younger galleries or galleries that specialize in emerging, that's what they focus on, right? So yeah, you want to capitalize on that opportunity. So that's one way of looking at your and other people's similar situation. But another one is when you get introduced to immediate success like that, does that ultimately become a diluting experience or a disillusioning experience in the long run?
Well, I tell you, I feel equally as grateful for the time after the period that I was just describing. Like I said, it wasn't easy. And I felt like I was fighting for my survival as an artist. And I'm very fortunate that my husband values me and my work, not only as a partner and, housemate and parent, mother and caregiver, but, as an artist, and he values my work as an artist. So from early on, he saw the struggle I was going through, and fortunately he's also a hard worker and a much better earner than I am. And he made it clear that having a studio and affording at least a sort of baseline minimum amount of time, for childcare per week to get time in the studio was just going to have to figure into our budget. And we'll, cut, what we can here and there to make it all work. So, but I'm very grateful for the time where the years that followed, this time of sort of going dark or going invisible from the eyes of the art world, because all of a sudden I realized that I had no audience. No one was looking. And while that was very disheartening and sort of deflating in one moment, it was incredibly liberating, and I could do whatever I wanted, and it was still my work, and it didn't have to look like what I think my work was supposed to look like or what people were expecting from me. And, my work is so much stronger, better, weirder, more interesting for it.
Did you actually recognize at the time, when you were going through this struggle, that this was the silver lining was that you had this opportunity to experiment, as opposed to continuing to make what was consistent with your brand, if you will, that you realized, oh, I can actually sort of fuck around now and not have any consequences?
Not entirely, I couldn't understand it entirely, until I sort of walked through the muck and painted through the muck, but partially because I was aware when I was pregnant, it was very difficult for me to paint. I was very distracted and preoccupied with what was going on in my body, and I didn't feel great physically either, and. Also, I was aware that this multi, year long line of questioning that had been driving my paintings since grad school and in the years following when I was showing with Taxter and Stengemann, that I was coming to the sort of natural conclusion of this line of questioning.
If you don't mind my asking, could you describe your income as a family, both during, the time that you were showing you had those two solo shows right out of grad school, and then subsequently, both your own and then your husband's, just so we can have a picture of that?
I think maybe your question is getting at something I said earlier about the radical shift or the shock of having a kid and having been, totally independent financially and able to pull my own weight financially through part-time work and freelance work, complementing the income from my shows and sales of my work, and then and my husband also doing the same, and each of us sort of just barely making enough to allow us the to pay the rent and still be able for him to go on tour for 3 weeks and then come back to a job or whatever, or for me to work for a week and then not work and just be in my studio for a couple of weeks. But all of that, again, like all of these changes, economic and our life changes, all kind of coincidentally piled up at once. So, that was sort of something I had never experienced before, having to, I remember the day that I was like, well, can you authorize me on your ATM card so I can get some money off the ATM machine? Can I get your PIN? Mm-hmm. And of course, and like we were already married, so it was like, oh yeah, like we could have a joint account, that people do that. Yeah, right. That, okay. But we hadn't before that. And then fortunately, he was able to make some steps and leaps, to sort of double down on his backup career as video. He's a video editor, so he works in film and television post-production, and sort of step up his ability to earn as mine kind of just totally flattened out.
What have you been doing? Because you alluded to part-time and freelance, but you didn't say what you were doing.
Oh, I have done all sorts of things, including but not limited to scenic painting for TV commercial shoots, and prop styling, and bartending, bar backing. I did have my first job. Actually not my first job out of undergrad, but one of my jobs as a recent, transplant to New York out of undergrad was a puppet doctor on an animated TV show on MTV called Celebrity Deathmatch.
I've heard of that. And, I remember that. Yeah. Wait, you were a puppet doctor?
Yeah. So art department type work for an animated TV show, but my official job title was puppet doctor. Mm-hmm. Because it was it was stop motion animation, and the show was shot with it was in the style of claymation, but the puppets are not so much really made out of clay or plasticine anymore because they melt under the hot lights. So they're made out of like foam rubber and wire armature, and they break, on set, and you have to swap them out with identical ones so that the animators can keep shooting and mm-hmm. the puppet doctors repair the puppets. And also because it's a death match, like a wrestling format
right.
show, there's all kinds of injuries and gore that is part of the script. And so that kind of it would be makeup special effects if it was on a human, but mm-hmm. for the puppet doctors take care of that.
Right. And what have you been doing most recently as far as work?
So I think, in the few years prior to getting in the family way, I was definitely feeling the call of the biological clock and my, thinking about work and what I wanted to be doing and where and what times of day I wanted to be doing it started shifting. So I had a friend who said she did bookkeeping, and she made a good hourly rate doing bookkeeping. And at that time, I had no idea what that even was, what the word bookkeeper means. But I was making most of my money through working at a bar at that time, which was a really awesome chapter of my life. But the late nights that were actually early mornings and, mm-hmm. and being on my feet and working that hard physically right. and in that environment was starting to get old. And so I was trying to make the transition out of working at night in a bar to working more in a daytime kind of office. So I met someone at a Christmas party for a production company that my husband was working for at the time. And she said, you know, oh, hi, you know, what do you do? And I said, I'm an artist. And what do you do? And she said, oh, I'm a bookkeeper. And I was like, oh my goodness, no way. I've been dying to get into bookkeeping. And I think she thought that was so hilarious.
Right.
That she was like, really? Like, are you serious? Like,
yeah.
Tell me more about being an artist, you know? And so
right.
I was like, well, if you ever need an assistant, you know, I'm looking to learn, because it's one of those things that you really have to learn, like by apprenticing or getting on the job training. It's very hard to learn it theoretically. And so we exchanged numbers, and she ended up being my mentor and teacher in the trade of bookkeeping. And I worked for her, and then gradually, you know, got my own clients. And that's the recession-proof job skill that I've been applying for about 10 years now.
Mazel tov. And so now you're just doing it as much as you want in terms of how many hours you need?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I have two young kids. I have almost 4-year-old and almost 9-year-old. And I have my painting studio in the garage. So, and then I do bookkeeping part-time. So, you know, it's great. It's nice to be able to work part-time and have the flexibility in my schedule to, you know, like I have a kid sick from home from school right now, actually.
Mm-hmm.
and then the days that I'm not doing bookkeeping and they're at school, I'm in the garage painting. And, you know, I feel really lucky to have this balance. I think I could work more hour, you know, it would be good to have more clients, but at the same time, like it seems like there's always something popping up out of the blue, and it's really great to have this flexibility in my schedule to be able to, you know, take care of that sick kid or, you know, put together the PDF or that exhibition opportunity that just came up last minute or whatever, you know, so
right.
It's a good mix for me right now.
Let's talk for sort of a final sort of stretch of our conversation about this artist-run gallery that you were in the mix of. You know, try to sort of do this thumbnail version of it if we can. So mm-hmm. Was it 2010 that you and friends from grad school, was it, put together this gallery?
Yeah, and it was the summer of 2010. I got a phone call from a friend, and she was telling me about how a bunch of our friends, that most of whom I knew from my time in Chicago in grad school, were talking about putting together, you know, starting an artist-run gallery in a space in Bushwick. And this was right after my first daughter had been born. So this was context, you know, of my mental state, having just been dropped by my gallery and having just given birth and experiencing all the soup of emotions and changes in responsibilities that came with. Listening to this conversation, what I thought she was asking me was, would I like to show my work at their new gallery they were putting together?
Right.
And I was like, oh, like in my head, like, oh, perfect timing. This is what I need right now. Like someone that sees me as an artist and sees my work and sees that I need to have a show, you know?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Then when she got to the punchline, it was like, so, and we couldn't, you know, we really want you to be a part of it with us and, you know, chip in some money that help pay the rent every month. And
right.
Like, we're having our first meeting tomorrow, if you can come.
Right.
And I had to laugh out loud at myself in that moment. And, you know, like I said, having been sort of stuck inside with a little baby for a few weeks on end, feeling kind of isolated and invisible, I said, well, sure, yeah, I'd love to come to your meeting and hear more about this gallery.
Mm-hmm.
So some friends had already had this idea, had been born out of a studio space that was leased in Bushwick at a very good rate, and they had more space than they needed for their to build out their two individual studios, and that's where the idea to get a larger group of people together to share the load of programming, well, finishing the building out and programming and paying for a gallery space in Bushwick.
Right.
And by the way, how that started.
And by the way, you mentioned Chicago a couple of times. Are we talking about the Art Institute that you guys went to?
No, I went to the University of Illinois at Chicago, UIC, it's also known as did quite a few of my fellow Regina Rexers, but some of those folks went to SAIC, the School of the Art Institute, and some of them didn't go to Chicago at all, but a lot of us have roots in Chicago, and everyone in the Regina Rex group had some connection to the group. You know, maybe they went to undergrad with one of these people that went to grad school in Chicago, and everyone had sort of like one degree of separation from
right.
Chicago.
Okay. And so you didn't all know each other beforehand?
Some of us maybe knew every single one of us in the group ahead of time. I probably knew like 80% of the folks.
Right,
and then
right.
there's like a few people that were like, oh, I'm so-and-so's friend from grad school and nice, you know, or from undergrad. And then, you know, then you got to know them.
Right. And how long did Regina Rex run? What was the length of the gallery?
Well, my involvement with Regina Rex was the 5-year period from 2010 to 2015 when I moved out here to LA with my family. And the gallery had moved from Bushwick to the Lower East Side by that time. And that Lower East Side gallery on Madison Street stayed open for another couple years.
Mm-hmm.
I think they just officially gave up that space about a year ago now.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
So I can't say exactly for sure what the like official status of Regina Rex is, because my official, in day-to-day involvement ended in 2015, but it's more or less, it's in spiritual form now.
Sure, right, right.
I don't want to say it's dead, but
right.
it's not in its physical state right now, and the people are all still, you know, close friends, and we're all still connected to each other, but I don't think there's a whole lot. I hesitate to say like there's nothing going on with Regina Rex, because one of the group of people could have something simmering that's about to boil up right now, and I just don't know about it. But
right, so you so in any
had
case,
a good like 7 years
right.
as a physical space.
And you guys were a pretty quite a successful artist-run gallery, as far as what I recall from the reputation. Can you just talk about generally and/or specifically, if you have specific anecdotes about what some of the takeaways you have from having been involved with it, like maybe some seminal experiences, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's been a lot. I mean, for starters, it was a greatly ameliorative experience for me to be a part of that group and to be working collaboratively to create opportunities to show the work of other artists who were, for whatever reason, not getting enough exposure, the work wasn't being seen. And so that was a great salve for my hurt ego and my hurt feelings and feeling like I'd been broken up with and sort of made to disappear.
Right,
then saddled with this baby, you know. Just that compliment to the solitary nature of working in the studio too, like just the extreme extroversion of working with a group of 12 or 13 people, and the arguments and the debates and the discussions and
That's what I'm interested in. That's what I'm particularly interested in. What I mean, what are your takeaways from some of those conversations? I mean, were there any? Did any themes or sensibilities or philosophies emerge, you know, from those debates that you can recall?
Well, I mean, I think it was just it was an ongoing process, and we were ever becoming, because we sort of never could agree on a mission or a sort of singular definition of what Regina Rex was or what it would do. But it was always like this, what could it be? What could it, you know, what could we do? So there was just any number of, you know, we met every week in person and had email correspondences amongst the 13 of us that went into the hundreds of like replies. And, you know, so we were, these kinds of discussions were happening constantly on an everyday basis, from like, you know, the beginning, where it was like, at one point someone proposed that Regina Rex be a gallery that only showed the work of deceased artists, or only showed the work of senior citizen artists, or, you know, these, you know, different ideas. But basically, I think it really came down to, you know, what do you as an individual care about to propose and fight for and get other people to support and help you realize, and how do you garner that support, you know, through these discussions? And if you can't garner support, can you at least figure out if, you know, like if someone opposes it or are they neutral on it? We had this saying where, you know, if somebody had an idea that was like, seemed like possible, but maybe you just didn't like their idea or didn't agree with it, or, you know, didn't think it sounded good, it would get to the point where someone would say, well, do you block this? Like, are you going to fall down on the floor and die? And, you know, like, if this happens, or, you know, is it over your dead body, or, you know, can we move forward with this? Mm-hmm. And so that was really more of a, you know, Regina Rex being a vehicle for experimentation and seeing what was possible, and garnering support within the group to make it happen. And, you know, we talked about, you know, how does being an artist-run gallery make us different from other kinds of commercial galleries? And, you know, should we represent artists? Should we have, you know, like a stable of represented artists? Should we have solo shows? I mean, all of these things came up for discussion. And ultimately, we did agree that we wanted to offer representation to a short list of artists, and, you know, what is it that we can provide, and what are the differences between being represented by Regina Rex and what maybe a more commercial, you know, fully realized, you know, for-profit capitalistic enterprise, what are the differences? But mm-hmm. We always you know, it was always pretty much run on a shoestring and out of the blood, sweat, and tears and love of doing it. Mm-hmm. So we were able to sell some work. I used the royal we sort of loosely, because that was not my area of expertise. But sales did happen eventually, and that just sort of helped to sustain the rent and to do the next show. But we did have to sort of venture into the like legit for-profit business entity to kind of, you know, once you start selling a few things, then, you know, probably a good idea to get a tax ID number and report the income and, you know, right. Kind of legitimize some of the things. But, you know, the early years were very much, you know, shoestring, utopian, you know, everyone pitches in. And just doing it for the ability to see a show that you think needs to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Right. And did you learn something, though, from, you mentioned that the sales wasn't really your expertise, and, you know, and other people got that done. Did you learn something from that, or was it like, no, these are the people who are going to, you know, these are the two or three Regina Rex members who are, you know, who are good at selling, and they're, you know, we can sort of, they're going to be the ones who sell.
I mean, it did sort of boil down to certain folks be, you know, having more of that je ne sais quoi, you know, like
right.
whatever that is.
Right.
And, you know, I think just being on the floor at the art fair with the iPad and like trying to talk to strangers about why they should, you know, like that sort of thing just
right.
would send my anxiety into spirals, you know?
Yeah.
We also had moments where we talked about hiring someone, like, okay, well, none of us are really cut out for this. So like, should we hire someone that works on commission or, you know, a consultant? Like, you know, there was like, well, what would that mean? Cause we're such a tight group and, you know, and we have this history and this like foundation, you know, that makes this Regina Rex. And so if we bring someone in to do sales, like, what's their status? You know, like, you know, they're a consultant. They won't be one of us, you know, but maybe they can help us do, you know, what we want to do. But in the end, I think that it was really like a wonderful utopian experiment that had a good stretch of utopian success before the reality of capitalism kind of
mm-hmm.
chewed it up and burned it out.
right.
But
you guys came together with no apparent common thread in terms of your sensibility or, you know, philosophy or what have you. So if you're all sort of debating for, you know, a show, it's kind of an exercise in compromise, it sounds like, on one hand, as
Absolutely.
Part of the experiment. Yeah. And also, as you articulated just a couple moments ago, an exercise in maximizing your debate skills.
You know, collaboration and compromise, you know, they're not synonymous, but they're not opposites either. And I think that
right.
Working in a group, compromise is a really important, or even in a partnership, in a marriage even, you know,
yeah.
compromise is a necessary ingredient. If, you know, you want to be able to bend and not break.
Right.
So, and definitely in Regina Rex, we found early on, because some of the first shows really were the manifestation of individual members' singular point of view that there were others supported in terms of helping to hang the work or edit a press release or whatnot. But we quickly learned that the shows that came together through a more collaborative process where the whole group was part of discussions about what the curatorial, you know, themes of the show would be and what kind of work would engage those ideas, and everybody putting artist names on the table and suggesting studio visits, and the evolution of the idea and the resulting show was always more interesting than whomever sort of initiated the conversation would say, like, oh, you know, this is so great, you know, this is better than if I could have done this by myself, but I think this is a way more interesting show, like, let's do things this way. And so we definitely observed that those differences and said, like, well, we prefer to work in this more openly collaborative way, and said, rather than saying, well, I'm going to do my show and then next show is going to be Yevgenia's show or, you know, Eli's show or whatever. And then, you know, I think it also makes people feel, if you know, I always felt like they're all our shows. There's no my show, your show next. And then, you know, we didn't show our own work.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't, you know, this idea of like taking turns like was less interesting than everyone feeling like they were responsible for and had a voice in each of the exhibition cycles.
Right. Well, I think that's a great place to leave it. Thank you very much for talking to me.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
And we're out. Thank you very much again to Anna for talking to me. I hope you guys found that intriguing, illuminating, and entertaining. And before I get to my little report on going to the ALAC Art Fair and old news, of course, I do want to remind you that this is a listener-supported show, and I would love to get some of you guys to contribute to the show financially if you haven't already, and I have a very interesting idea for a donation, one which barely anybody, if anybody, has ever done on a podcast. First, let me say, if you would like to make a financial donation of $30 or more to this show via either Venmo, PayPal, or Patreon, where you can donate on an ongoing basis for as little as a dollar a month, but if you get up to $30 in any one of those forms, I will send you all 7 of the bonus episodes, as well as, if you want one, get you a podcast bumper sticker featuring the Conversation Art Podcast logo and or the P Word bumper sticker. And if you haven't heard about that, just ask me. I don't want to bore people who've already heard about it too many times. So thank you very much in advance. Of course, you can also follow the show. You can support the show by spreading the word and get us advertisers. Follow the show on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. And you can also support the show in a very indirect way by listening to my other newer show called How I Get By, about how people get by financially, not artists, just really anybody across the financial and economic spectrum. We're up to 20 episodes, 21 by the Monday after this comes out. So yeah, go check it out. It's good listening in between the conversation, I think. And I would love to hear from more of you what you think about that show. All right, so here's my weird, my very odd contribution to the show request. I was at my parents' over the holiday weekend and the President's Day weekend, as they call it here in the States, and watched 3 more, maybe 4 more episodes, having already seen the first 2 of My Brilliant Friend, which is a phenomenal series. If you haven't seen it and you have access to it, or if you can get access to it, absolutely phenomenal filmic adaptation of the Elena Ferrante Neapolitan series. I have only read the first one, which I believe is called My Brilliant Friend, of the 3. But in any case, the show is so well done. It's really more of a series of films than TV, I would say. Anyway, all that said, if you have an HBO Go password that you would like to donate to me so I can watch the final 2 episodes, I would be so grateful. Intriguing idea, right? All right. So Art Los Angeles Contemporary, known in shorthand as ALAC and ALAC. And of course, this was a week that included, of course, the Freeze Art Fair, which made its debut in LA, the Felix Art Fair, which was at the Roosevelt Hotel, the Spring Break Art Fair, and maybe the Startup Art Fair. There were a couple more. I apologize if you were involved in the other 1 or 2 of what their names were. But in any case, it was a week filled with art fairs in LA. I went to Art Los Angeles Contemporary, which actually had its 10-year anniversary, and I went on Thursday around noon, late morning around noon. No, it was about 12:30, I should say, and with a friend. And I had not been to an art fair probably in about 3 years, maybe 4. The Perry Photo LA was the last one I went to, which is at Paramount Studios, I believe, the same location as Freeze, but, you know, obviously in a different configuration. In any case, here are my impressions. I got to see, I knew a few of the dealers, chatted with them, met a dealer that I didn't know, didn't even know his gallery existed, saw a couple of artists that I know. You know, it was pretty mellow. It was very mellow, actually. It was a Thursday, slow day, obviously, because there's a lot of competition for other spaces, plus maybe other people were going to galleries, who knows what. So it was not crowded. But here's my big takeaway, which I, as far as my experience, I do not envy people who sit the booths, or, you know, as you would say in the old days, man or woman, maybe man or woman, or non-gender specific of the booth of an art fair, because it's a tough dynamic. I mean, maybe you just sort of sit in your phone or your computer and kind of blot out what's going on. But I noticed everything from people who are in their own conversations in their booths, oblivious to whoever was visiting them, all the way to a guy who was manning a booth that was a horizontal booth as opposed to more of a square one. So you would walk along the aisle and the booth unfolded sort of horizontally as you walked, and it had these pink sculptures. He was really actively sort of looking out into the people walking down the hall. He was just so raring to have a conversation and tell you about what was going on. But he did not, he did not say hello or force it upon you. So I guess, he wasn't overly aggressive about it. But the body language was kind of like, I would love to tell you about this work or just have a conversation with you. So I think that is kind of my larger metaphysical, if you will, experience with the art fair. Otherwise, I mean, like a lot of people, I don't need to see art fairs, you know. I mean, I am more happy going to galleries and museums and whatnot, and taking art in that way. So, all right, enough about that. That's my two cents. Definitely let me know what your experience was if you want, and I can share it on a future episode. So here is the old news for this weekend nearing the end of February. Planning an art fair called You Can't Take It With You, where all offers to purchase will be politely refused. Economics still needs finessing. Martin Herbert. A poop museum, let me try that again. A poop museum is coming to Japan. The itinerary for your dream trip to Japan just got a little longer. A pop-up poop museum is coming to Yokohama, Japan's second largest city by population, and an area that's easily reached by bullet train from Tokyo. The Unko Museum, poop museum, is slated to open March 15th, around the same time that international tourists will start flocking to Japan to take part in Sakura season, which marks the annual blooming of the country's pretty pink cherry blossoms. Turd-themed installations seem to be the antithesis of fresh, delicate flowers, but this museum won't be obscene or crass. Like most things in Japan, this poop will be kawaii, which is Japanese for all things adorable. The Instagram-friendly museum will be championed by its resident mascot, Umberuto, who happens to be a literal walking pile of poo who carries a toilet around on his shoulder as if it were a boombox. Poop Boy, another anthropomorphic feces figure from the 1984 manga series Dr. Slump, is said to have inspired much of Japan's poop kawaii culture. Mental floss. And just as a side note, here in Los Angeles at Hauser and Worth downtown, the Piero Manzoni show recently opened, which I have not seen yet, but he, you know, associated with a particular excretion. Police break into art gallery after mistaking dummy for corpse. Security cameras at a London art gallery recorded police breaking through a glass door to investigate a person in distress that turned out to be a dummy. A London police spokesman confirmed officers and paramedics responded to a witness report of a suspected corpse just inside the glass doors at the Factory Art Gallery in Dalston. The security camera footage shows police reaching the supposed person and discovering it was a mannequin. Quote, "Offers and LAS attended the scene. Officers were required to force entry inside," unquote, a spokesman told the London Evening Standard. Upon inspection, the person turned out to be a figurine constructed from clothing and wires and was part of an art installation. Collier Din Bangura, 36, said the dummy was part of his solo exhibition about the experiences of refugees in Britain. Quote, "I have used the same dummy before in other shows, but this is the first time it's caused police to be called. When I came to the studio and saw the smashed glass, I immediately thought it had been vandalized. But the police left a note behind explaining what happened," Din Bangura said. The note reads, "Police forced entry by smashing the window due to getting calls from members of the public regarding a dead body inside the building. If you have any issues, please write to the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, UPI. And finally, did art ever solve social issues? It often addresses them, but I can't think of any, that, quote, solved, unquote, issues, or even changed minds. Usually socially aware art provides a hall of mirrors for like-minded viewers via Alain Servais. Okay, and finally, before we go, I just want to add to that final old news to say that I am a little more than halfway through this book, which addresses, to some extent, how art functions out in the world, particularly vis-a-vis capitalism and financialization. And I am so looking forward. I know I'm kind of shooting my load a little early, but I'm looking forward to having this writer and professor on the show in the near future. So stay tuned for that. Thank you very much for being here. I hope you are having a good winter and you're not freezing your ass off. And I will talk to you soon. Ciao for now.